was just the kind of world it was with these sweet girls around. "I can't believe you are an old widow," said Miranda Depp. "And so little," said Susanna Briggs. "You who was always so pretty," said Miranda Depp. "You had it rough," said Cynthia Hoynton. "The tide ran out but never ran in," said Susanna Briggs. "The stones rolled downhill but never rolled back up," said Cynthia Hoynton. "You never in your life was given enough," said Miranda Depp. My eyes teared up. "That is so true," I said. "You are a wave that has crashed upon the shore," said Miranda. "We say these things to speed you along," said Susanna. I said I didn't know about any of that, but sure would fancy another of those pills. "Come with us, then," Miranda said. The McBaines in the gully paused to listen, as did the cows, as did, somehow, the barn. I was so tired, and had been tired for ever so long. "I believe I will come with," I said.
From off to my left came a shout. Of terror or victory, I could not be sure. Followed by the familiar yet always bone-chilling fire sound associated with the matter-light-blooming phenomenon. Who had gone? I could not tell, and was still too under siege myself to care.
As if stimulated by this victory, our tormentors now redoubled their efforts.
Rose petals rained down, a joyful provocation, red, pink, yellow, white, purple. Then translucent petals, striped petals, dotted petals, petals inscribed. When you took one from the ground and looked closely at it, with detailed images down to the broken flower stems and dropped toys of one's childhood yard. Finally, golden petals rained down, of real gold, ticking with each impact against tree or marker stone.
Then, singing. Beautiful singing, filled with longing, promise, reassurance, patience. Deep fellow feeling.
It affected one deeply.
"You wanted to fucking dance.
But you also wanted to fucking cry.
While dancing."
"Mother came. About 10 of her. But none smelled the least like mother. Say, what is that trick? To send a lonesome fellow 10 false mothers. 'Come with us, Willie,' one mother said. But then, all of a sudden, they did smell right, very right, and cuddled in around me, smelling right. Mother, my goodness, good old. You are a wave that has crashed upon the shore," said a second mother. "Dear Willie," said a third. "Dear, dear Willie," said a fourth. "And all of those mothers loved me so, and wanted me to go with, and said they would take me home, soon as I was ready."
"When will you know the full pleasures of the marriage bed? When behold Anna's naked form? When will she turn to you in that certain state, mouth hungry, cheeks flushed? When will her hair, loosened in a wanton gesture, fall at last around you?" Thus spoke Elsbeth Grove, my wife's cousin, or rather spoke a deceiving creature fashioned into the exact image of Elsbeth, in a thinnish thing, silk collar fluttering. "I'll tell you when," said a second bride, whom I now recognized as my own dear grandmother, also arrayed disconcertingly in a thinnish thing, collar fluttering. "Never. That's finished now. You delude yourself, Kugel." Since their last visit, they had somehow acquired my nickname. "It troubles Anna that you remain here," Elsbeth said. "She asked me to relay this message. I was weakening with every second, and knew I must rally some defense." "Is she there now," I said, "waiting for me, in that place to which you so eloquently urge me to go?" I had them now, for though they are happy enough to deceive, they prefer not to lie. Elsbeth, blushing, cast an anxious glance at Grandmother. It is rather difficult to answer your question, Elsbeth said. You are demons, I said, who assume these familiar forms to lure me thither. My, but you are honest, Kugel, said Grandmother. Are you so honest regarding your own situation? Said Elsbeth. Are you sick, Kugel? Said Grandmother. Do doctors put sick people into sick boxes? I do not recall that practice ever being followed in our time, Elsbeth said. Therefore, what must we conclude, Kugel? Said Grandmother. What are you? Where are you? Admit it, dearest. Believe it. Say it aloud. Profit by it. Join us. We say these things to speed you along, said Elsbeth. And I saw that I must apply the ultimate antidote. To whom do you speak? I said. Who is hearing you? To whom do you listen? Whose hand do you now follow, as it lifts to point to the heavens? What is the source of the voice causing those looks of consternation to appear even now upon your faces? Here I am. I am here. Am I not? This had its usual effect. Confused and deflated, the brides huddled, whispering to one another, devising a new plan of attack. Fortunately, at that moment, their fraudulent conference was disrupted by the sound of two more distinct and separate fire-sound, matter-light-blooming occurrences, one from the south, one from the northwest.
Eddie took off running at them sounds. Sometimes he gets pretty fucking scared of shit. One of them sluts came right up to me. Then I seen it is not a slut, but our own daughter, Mary Mag. All fucking dressed up, finally come to visit after all these fucking years of not. Mother, she said, we are sorry to have been so remiss, Everett and I. Who's Everett? I said. Your son, she said. My brother. Edward, you mean? I said. Eddie? Eddie Jr.? Edward, yes, correct, sorry, she said. Anyway, we should have come a long time ago, but I have been quite busy being successful and loved and producing many children of surpassing beauty and intelligence, as has Everett. Edward, I said. Edward, yes, she said. I am just so exhausted from all my successes. Well, that's all right, I said. You're here now, kid. And Mother, she said, please know, everything is all right. You did the best you could. We blame you for nothing. Although we know that you feel you may have at times exhibited certain defects of maternal... I was kind of a shit mother, wasn't I? I said. Whatever failures you feel you may have been responsible for, leave them behind you now, she said. All turned out beautifully. Come with us.
Come where, though, I said. I don't...
You are a wave that has crashed upon the shore, she said.
See, I don't get that, I said. Just then, Eddie came racing back. My hero! Ha! Huh? Clear the fuck out of here, you, he said. It's Mary Mag, I said. No, it ain't, he said. Watch this! He picked up a stone and shagged it. Right at Mary Mag. As the stone passed through, she was not Mary Mag anymore at all, but I don't fucking know who or what. Some blob or blast of sun in the shape of a goddamn dress.
You, sir, are a fool, the light blob said. Then it turned to me. You, madam, it said, are less so.
The lead angel took my face into her hands as her wing swished back and forth, putting me in mind of a horse's tail as that animal feeds. Are you thriving here, Reverend? She said, wing extended lazily above her. Is he whom you served in life present here? I believe he is, I said. He is, of course, everywhere, she said, but does not like to see you lingering here, among such low companions. Her beauty was considerable and increasing by the second. I saw I must end our interview or risk disaster. Please go, I said. I do not require you today. But soon, I think, she said. Her beauty swelled beyond description, and I burst into tears.
As abruptly as it had begun, the onslaught now ended.
As if upon some common signal, our tormentors departed, their song turning somber and mournful.
The trees went gray in their wake. The food vanished. The streams receded. The breeze fell. The singing ceased.
And we were alone.
And all was dismal again.
30.
Mr. Volman, Reverend Thomas, and I went forth immediately to determine who had succumbed.
The first had been the frugal Mrs. Blass.
Scattered around the surface of her home place were her treasured dead bird parts, twigs, motes, et al., now unattended, objects of value no more.
A.G. Coombs, it appeared, had been the second to succumb.
Poor fellow. None of us knew him well. He had been here many years, but only rarely left his sick box.
And when he did, was always heard to bark, "Do you know who I am, sir? They hold me a table at Binlay's. I wear the Legion of the Eagle." I still recall his shock when I told him I did not know of that place. "Binlay's is the finest house of the city," he exclaimed. "Of what city?" I inquired, and he said, "Washington," and described the location of that place, but I knew that intersection, and it was most decidedly a place of stables, and I told him so. "I pity you," he said, but I had shaken him. He sat a while on his mound, pensively stroking his beard. "But surely you know the esteemed Mr. Humphreys," he thundered. And now he was gone. "Goodbye, Mr. Coombs, and may they know of Binlay's wherever you are bound."
We wandered past many sitting dejectedly upon their mounds or the steps of their stone homes, weeping with the effort of resistance. Others sat quietly sorting through the various seductive visions and temptations to which they had lately been exposed.
I felt a renewed affection for all who remained.
Wheat had been separated from chaff.
"Our path is not for everyone. Many people, I do not mean to disparage them, lack the necessary resolve."
"Nothing matters sufficiently to them. That is the thing."
Unsure of who the third victim had been, we suddenly remembered the lad.
It seemed unlikely that one so young could have survived such a merciless assault.
This being the desired outcome.
Given his youth.
The alternative being his eternal enslavement.
We found ourselves in a saddened but relieved state of mind as we set off to confirm his departure.
31.
Imagine our surprise when we found him sitting cross-legged on the roof of the white stone home.
"Still here?" Mr. Volman said in amazement. "Yes," the lad answered dryly.
His appearance was startling.
The effort of resistance had cost him dearly.
These young ones are not meant to tarry.
He was out of breath. His hands were shaking. He had lost, by my estimation, approximately half his body weight. His cheekbones protruded. His shirt collar hung huge about his suddenly stick-like neck. Charcoal dark rings had appeared under his eyes, all of these combining to give him a peculiar wraith-like appearance.
He had been a chubby boy.
But was chubby no longer.
"Good God," Mr. Bevins whispered.
It had taken the trainer girl nearly a month to descend to this level.
"The fact that you are still here is impressive," the Reverend said to the lad. "Heroic, even," I added. "But ill-advised," said the Reverend.
"It is all right," Mr. Volman said gently. "Really, it is. We are here. Proceed in peace. You have provided us ample hope that will last us many years and do us much good. We thank you. We wish you well. We bless your departure."
"Yes, only I am not going," the boy said.
At this, the Reverend's face registered a degree of surprise even more pronounced than the usual considerable level of surprise recorded there.
Father promised, the boy said. How would that be if he came back and found me gone? Your father is not coming back, said Mr. Vollman. No time soon, anyway, I said. At which point you will be in no condition to receive him, said Mr. Vollman. If your father comes, the Reverend said, we will tell him you had to leave. Explain to him that it was for the best. You lie, the boy said. It appeared the boy's degradation had now begun to affect his disposition. I beg your pardon, said the Reverend. You three have lied to me from the first, the boy said. Said I should go. What if I had? I would have missed Father entirely. And now you say you will give him a message? We will, the Reverend said. We most certainly. But how will you? The boy said. Have you a method of communication? I did not when I was there within him.
We do, said Mr. Vollman. We do have such a method.
Nebulous, far from established.
There has historically been some confusion around this issue.
Just then, from across the premises, came the sound of Mrs. Delaney calling out for Mr. Delaney.
Many years ago, her husband had preceded her to this place, but was no longer here. That is to say, though his sick form lay just where she had put it, Mr. Delaney himself
was elsewhere.
Had gone on.
However, poor Mrs. Delaney could not resolve to follow.
Because of some funny business that had taken place with another Mr. Delaney.
The brother of her husband.
It had not felt funny at the time, but urgent, faded, and wonderful.
But now she was of a divided heart. Having spent many years in that previous place, longing for this other Delaney, miserably trapped in her marriage.
She had, within a month of her husband having come here, taken up with that other Delaney, only to find him at once falling in her estimation, because of the reckless disregard he had shown for her husband's, his brother's, memory. This revealing to her that he was of a decayed and avaricious moral character, unlike her husband, who had been, she now saw, upstanding in every way.
Albeit rather literal and timid and not nearly the imposing and alluring physical specimen that he, the morally suspect brother, was.
So she found herself stuck.
Physically longing for that Delaney, still back there, in that previous place.
But also desiring to go and see her husband again and apologize.
For having wasted the many years of their life together, craving another man.
In short, she did not know whether she was coming or going.
Going or waiting.
So just wandered around shouting, Mr. Delaney!
Continuously.
We never knew which Delaney she was calling for.
Nor did she.
I say, the lad suddenly gasped, an unmistakable quaver of fear in his voice.
Looking over, my heart sank. The roof around him had liquefied, and he appeared to be sitting in a gray-white puddle.
From out of the puddle, a vine-like tendril emerged.
Thickening as it approached the boy, it flowed cobra-like over the juncture at which his calves crossed.
Reaching to brush it away, I found it stiff, more stone than snake.
A chilling development.
The beginning of the end.
32.
If Miss Traynor's case was any indication, this tendril would soon be followed by a succession of others until the boy was fully secured, Gulliver-like, to the roof.
Once secured, he would be rapidly overgrown by what might best be described as a placental sheen.
This sheen then hardening into a shell-like carapace, that carapace would begin to transition through a series of others, viz., the fallen bridge, vulture, dog, terrible hag, etc., each more detailed and hideous than the last, this process only serving to increase the speed of his downward spiral. The more perverse the carapace, the less light, happiness, honesty, positive aspiration would get in.
Driving him ever further from the light.
These memories of Miss Traynor depressed us.
Bringing to our minds, as they did, the shame of that long-ago night.
On which we had abandoned her.
Stumbling away, heads lowered.
tacitly assenting to her doom.
As she descended.
We remembered her singing merrily all through the initial carapacing, as if to deny what was happening.
A heavy bow hung down.
Dear child.
Lovely voice.
Which became steadily less lovely as the initial carapace formed and she took on the form of a girl-sized crow.
Cawing out a nightmarish version of that tune.
Flailing at us whenever we drew too near, with one human arm and that tremendous black wing.
We had not done enough.
Being rather newly arrived back then.
And much preoccupied with the challenges of staying.
Which were not inconsiderable.
And if not lessened in the meantime.
My opinion of myself fell somewhat on that occasion.
Yes.
The chapel bell now tolled three.
Jolting us back to the present, producing its usual strange, discordant aftertone.
Selfish, selfish, selfish.
The chief, too, of Mr. Bevan's eyes widened, as if to say, "Gentlemen, it is time to go."
And yet we lingered, brushing away such tendrils as appeared.
The lad had fallen silent.
Turned inward.
Fading in and out of consciousness.
Mumbling and tossing, apparently lost in some delirious dream.
"Mother," he whispered.
33.
Mother says I may taste of the Candy City, once I am up and about. She has saved me a chocolate fish and a bee of honey. Says I will some day command a regiment, live in a grand old house, marry some sweet and pretty thing, have little ones of my own. I like that. All of us will meet in my grand old house and have a fine. I will make the jolliest old lady, Mother says. You boys will bring me cakes. Round the clock, while I just sit. How fat I will be. You boys must buy a cart and take turns wheeling me around. Mother has such a nice way of laughing. We are on the third stair step, number three, that has three white roses on it. Here is how it goes from stair step number one to stair step number five in number of white roses. 2, 3, 5, 2, 6. Mother comes in close, touches her nose to mine. This is called knee-knee, which I find babyish, but still I allow it from time to. Father comes along, says, "Say, can I get in on this pile-up?" He can. If Father puts his knees on stair-step number two and stretches, he can reach with his fingers to stair-step number 12. He is that long, has done it many times. No more pile-ups, unless I am strong. Therefore I know what I must stay. Is not easy, but I know honor. Fix bayonets. How to be brave is not easy. Remember Colonel Ellis, killed by Rebs, for bravely tearing down the Reb flag from a private. I must stay. If I wish to get home, when will I, when may I? Never if weak, maybe if strong.
34.
The boy's eyes flew open.
"Strange here," he said. "Not strange," said Mr. Bevins, "not really." "One gets used to it," said the Reverend, "if one belongs here." said Mr. Bevins. "Which you don't," said the Reverend.
Just then, three gelatinous orbs floated past, as if seeking someone.
And we realized that Mrs. Ellis had been the third of us to succumb.
The orbs were now empty, i.e. contained no daughters.
They paraded sourly by, seemed to glare at us, drifted away down the steep incline to the creek, became dimmer, finally vanished entirely.
"Not strange at all," said Mr. Bevins, blushing slightly.
35.
And there came down upon us a rain of hats.
Of all types.
Hats, laughter, crude jests, the sound of fart noises made by mouths from on high. These were the harbingers of the approach of the three bachelors.
Though only they among us could fly, we did not envy them.
Having never loved or been loved in that previous place, they were frozen here in a youthful state of perpetual emotional vacuity, interested only in freedom, profligacy, and hijinks, railing against any limitation or commitment whatsoever.
Were all for fun and jollity, distrusted anything serious, lived only for their rollicks.
Their boisterous cries often resounding above our premises.
Some days it was just a steady rain of hats.
Of all types.
Of which they seemed to have an inexhaustible supply.
A derby, a tinsel-edged cocked, four nice feathered Scotch caps dropped now in rapid succession, followed by the bachelors themselves, who touched down gallantly on the roof of the Whitestone home, each tipping his own hat or cap as he did so. "By your leave," said Mr. Lippert, "we seek a respite." "Flying tires us," said Mr. Kane. "Though we love it," said Mr. Fuller. "Ye gods," said Mr. Kane, catching sight of the boy. "He don't look so pert," said Mr. Fuller. I have been somewhat ill," the lad said, rousing himself.
"I should say so," said Mr. Kane.
"'Tis a bit ripe in this country," said Mr. Fuller, pinching his nose closed.
"My father was here and has promised to return," the boy said. I am trying to last."
"All best wishes with that," said Mr. Lippert, raising an eyebrow.
"Mind your leg there, kiddo," said Mr. Kane.
Distracted by our guests, we had been remiss. The boy's left leg was now webbed to the roof by several stout new tendrils, each the width of a wrist.
"Goodness," the boy said, blushing.
The labor required to get him free was not insignificant, roughly equivalent to that required to uproot a tangle of blackberry roots. He bore the considerable discomfort of that procedure with a soldierly fixity of mind for one so young, letting out only a stoic grunt at each tug, and then, exhausted, fell back into that earlier state of disassociated torpor. "This father of his," said Mr. Fuller in an undertone, "long-legged fellow?"
"Somewhat dolorous in aspect," said Mr. Lippert.
"Tall, a bit raggedy-seeming," said Mr. Kane.
"Yes," I said.
"Just past him," said Mr. Fuller.
"I beg your pardon," I said.
"Just past him," said Mr. Kane.
"Here?" Mr. Volman said incredulously.
"Still here?"
"Out near Bellingweather, husband father shipwright," said Mr. Lippert.
"Sitting all quiet-like," said Mr. Fuller.
"Just past him," said Mr. Kane.
"Toodaloo," said Mr. Fuller. "You will excuse us," said Mr. Lippert. "This is the time of night when we must rapidly circumnavigate the entire premises, hovering only inches away from that dread fence, to see which of us may come the closest, even while experiencing those nauseating effects conveyed via proximity to same."
And off they went, emitting a perfect major triad via fart noises with their mouths, sending down, as if in farewell, a rain of celebratory hats. Flared tops, Turkish house caps, kepis of various colors, a flower-bedecked straw falling rather more slowly than the rest, a lovely thing, redolent of summer.
This revelation left us dumbstruck.
Strange that the gentleman had come here in the first place. Stranger still that he lingered.
The bachelors were not entirely trustworthy.
Terrified of boredom, they were prone to pranks.
Had once convinced Mrs. Tessenbaum she was manifesting in lingerie.
after which she spent several years cowering behind a tree.
Occasionally hid tiny Mrs. Blass's dead bird parts, twigs, pebbles, and motes.
Causing her to race frantically about the premises while they hovered above, encouraging her with false suggestions to leap over fallen branches and cross narrow rivulets, which did not seem narrow to her, poor thing, but like great rushing streams.
Any assertion by the bachelors must therefore be regarded with suspicion.
Still, this was intriguing.
Merited further investigation.
I think not, the Reverend said sharply, as if intuiting our intention, then indicated with a meaning glance that he wished a confidential word.
36.
We three sank through the roof, into the white stone home.
It was several degrees cooler there. It smelled of old leaves and mold.
And of the gentleman, slightly.
We are here by grace, the Reverend said, our ability to abide far from assured. Therefore we must conserve our strength, restricting our activities to only those which directly serve our central purpose. We would not wish through profligate activity to appear ungrateful for the mysterious blessing of our continued abiding, for we are here, but for how long or by what special dispensation, it is not ours to—
Several of Mr. Bevan's many eyes, I noted, were rolling.
Waiting for the Reverend to dismount from his high horse, Mr. Volman was amusing himself by repeatedly placing a pebble on his tremendous member and watching it tumble down.
We must look out for ourselves, the Reverend said, and by doing so we protect the boy as well. He must hear nothing of this rumor, which would only serve to raise his hopes. As we know, only utter hopelessness will lead him to do what he must. Therefore not a word. Are we in agreement? We mumbled our assent.
Lacking the necessary spring in his ancient legs, he had come here already quite old— The Reverend began clawing his way up one wall and soon, though not that soon, vanished through the ceiling.
Leaving Mr. Bevins and me there below, alone.
In truth, we were bored, so very bored, so continually bored.
Each night passed with a devastating sameness.
We had sat every branch on every tree, had read and reread every stone, had walked down, run down, crawled down, laid upon every walk, path, and weedy trail, had waded every brook, possessed a comprehensive knowledge of the textures and tastes of the four distinct soil types here, had made a thorough inventory of every hairstyle, costume, hairpin, watch fob, sock brace, and belt worn by our compatriots. I had heard Mr. Volman's story many thousands of times, and had, I fear, told him my own at least as many times.
In short, it was dull here, and we craved the slightest variation.
Anything new was a treasure. We longed for any adventure, the merest lark.
There would be no harm, we thought, in taking a quick trip.
Out to where the gentleman sat.
We need not even tell the Reverend we were going. We could just go.
It was always a relief to be free of the old bore for a bit.
37.
Bursting out through the front wall, Mr. Bevins and I set off.
Ignoring the Reverend's peevish cries of protest from the roof.
Cutting down through the clover-engorged dell occupied by the seven flood-sickened members of the Palmer family, we shortly reached that thin gray slate trail that runs below, passing between Coates on one side and Wemberg on the other.
Wended our way past Federley, blessed are those who die in the light.
A chess-piece-looking monument, topped with a vase that ends in what looks like a nipple.
And proceeded to the M. Boyden, G. Boyden, Gray, Hebbard cluster.
Into that slight hollow which is, in spring, overgrown with foxglove and cone flower.
But was now a massive, dormant tangle of gray.
Wherein two slothful winter birds glared at us as we passed.
Birds being distrustful of our ilk.
Jogging down the far side of the North Hill, we greeted Merkel, kicked by a bull but still looking forward to the dance, Posterbell, a dandy whose looks had gone, who fervently wished that his hair might be restored and his gums might reverse their recession and the muscles of his arms might no longer resemble flaccid straps, and his dinner suit be brought to him, and a bottle of scent and a bouquet of flowers, so that he might once again go courting. Mr. and Mrs. West, fire with no possible cause, as they were always meticulously careful regarding management of the hearth, and Mr. Dill, mumbling contentedly about his grandson's excellent university marks, eagerly anticipating the spring graduation.
And proceeded past Trevor Williams, former hunter, seated before the tremendous heap of all the animals he had dispatched in his time, hundreds of deer, 32 black bear, 3 bear cubs, innumerable coons, lynx, foxes, mink, chipmunks, wild turkeys, woodchucks and cougars, scores of mice and rats, a positive tumble of snakes, hundreds of cows and calves, 1 pony, carriage struck, 20,000 or so insects, each of which he must briefly hold with loving attention for a period ranging from several hours to several months, depending on the quality of loving attention he could muster and the state of fear the beast happened to have been in at the time of its passing. Being thus held, the product of time and loving attention being found sufficient, that is, that particular creature would heave up, then trot or fly or squirm away, diminishing Mr. Williams' heap by 1.
It was an extraordinary pile, nearly as tall as the chapel spire.
He had been a prodigious hunter and had many years of hard work yet ahead of him.
He called out to us, arms full of calf, asking us to keep him company, saying that his was good toil but lonely, as he was not permitted to ever stand and stroll about.
I explained to him that we were on an urgent mission and must not delay.
Mr. Williams, a good sort, never unhappy, always cheerful, since his conversion to gentleness, acknowledged that he understood by waving 1 hoof of the calf.
38.
Soon we approached the massive collier sick home of Italian marble, encircled by 3 concentric rose gardens, marked on either side by an ornate fountain, waterless now for winter.
When one owns 4 homes and has 15 full-time gardeners perfecting one's 7 gardens and 8 man-made streams, one will, of necessity, spend a great deal of time racing between homes and from garden to garden, and so it is perhaps not surprising if, one afternoon, rushing to check on the progress of a dinner one's cook is preparing for the board of one's favorite charity, one finds oneself compelled to take a little rest, briefly dropping to one knee, then both knees, then pitching forward onto one's face, and, unable to rise, proceeding here for a more prolonged rest, only to find it not restful at all, since, while ostensibly resting, one finds oneself continually fretting about one's carriages, gardens, furniture, homes, et al., all of which, one hopes, patiently await one's return, not having, heaven forfend, fallen into the hands of some reckless, careless, undeserving other.
Percival-Collier.
Mr. Collier, shirt clay-stained at the chest from his fall, nose crushed nearly flat, was constantly compelled to float horizontally, like a human compass needle, the top of his head facing in the direction of whichever of his properties he found himself most worried about at the moment. The top of his head was now facing west. Our arrival, causing his worrying to wane, he let out an involuntary gasp of pleasure, bobbed up to vertical, and turned to face us.
"Mr. Collier," said Mr. Volman. "Mr. Volman," said Mr. Collier.
A new property worry then crossing his mind, he was thrown violently forward, stomach down, and with a grunt of dread spun to face north.
39.
Next, we must shortcut through that swampy little section populated by our very lowest.
They sought the damp and moonless feeling here.
Here stood Mr. Randall and Mr. Twood, in perpetual conversation.
Rendered mutually inarticulate by we knew not what misfortune.
Faces reduced to gauzy, unreadable smudges.
Torsos gray and shapeless, but for the slightest torpedo-shaped suggestion of arms and legs.
Indistinguishable, except that Mr. Twood's movements retained a touch more vitality. Every now and then, as if making an attempt at persuasion, one of his arm-like appendages would pop up, as if to indicate on a shelf something to which he wished to call Mr. Randall's attention.
Mr. Twood having been, we believed, in the retail line.
Drag out the big signage. Immediately put it away again. Drag it out again. Not let slip from grasp. Significantly reduced women's.
Mr. Benjamin Twood.
In response, the gray, faceless wedge that had been Mr. Randall would sometimes enact a little dance.
Yield the seat. Here's a fellow who can really tinkle the twinklers, and the bloke at the piano would proffer his, and it was all me.
Jasper Randall.
Sometimes near sunrise, when all the other swamp denizens were weary and depleted and had self-stacked and gone mute near the lightning-blasted black oak, Mr. Randall could be found bowing over and over again, as if to an imagined audience.
Leading us to surmise that he must have been a performer of some type.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Extraordinary value within. Only recall your thin, weary mother, who might yet be saved by the auto iron, the cranking grater, the cold box, the auto salter, her once fine posture revived, her winsome, kind smile revived, as of yore, when, in short knees, you sported a branch saber among the general pie odor.
Slam arpeggio pause for smoke drink. When I slammed a good one, small ripples would appear in the golden drink set before.
Any admiration we might once have felt for their endurance had long since devolved into revulsion.
Were we destined for a similar fate?
We thought not.
Regularly scanned each other's features for any indication of facial smudging.
Continually monitored ourselves for the slightest degradation in diction.
And they were far from the worst.
Consider Mr. Papers.
Essentially a cringing gray supine line.
Of whom one would only become aware once one had stumbled over him.
Can Harry any help, mate? Come. To hit me. Can Harry help? Can any wonder? Help. Can I get you an heap? Unclog? May. Please help me.
L.B. Papers.
We had no idea what Mr. Papers might previously have been.
There being so little of him remaining.
Go on, move along, else receive an unglad message and you're bent over. I'll come right up under and ventilate your under-tenting.
Flanders Quinn.
Former robber.
Bevins. I'll piss a line of toxic in your wretched twin wrist cuts. Gropping you by your club dick, Valman, I'll slang you into the black fence.
I, for one, was afraid of him.
I was not afraid of him. Exactly. But we had urgent business. Must not linger.
And Trot skimmed off along the swamp margin, Quinn cursing us, then reversing himself and supplicating us to return, as he was frightened to stay in that place, and yet more frightened to leave it and go. Since what must become of a sinner who had slit the throats of a merchant and his daughter beside a broken-wheeled Fredericksburg carriole, plucked the pearls from her very neck and wiped them blood-free with her own silk wrap?
Regaining higher ground, we put on the speed, passed through the leaning tool shed, crossed the gravel road, and made good time along the old carriage path, which still retained, to my nostrils, some faint mysterious scent of newsprint.
40.
Just ahead now, past the slightly left-leaning Cafferty obelisk, a crowd had gathered around a freshly filled sick hole.
Mr. Volman approached the group. Is the new arrival still with us? He delicately inquired. He is, yes, replied Tobin, Badger, Muller, bent as always, nearly double with toil. Shut your trap so I can hear him, barked Mrs. Sparks on all fours, ear to the ground.
41.
Wife of my heart, Laura, Laura, I take up my pen in a state of such great exhaustion that only my deep love for all of you could so compel me after a day of such unholy slaughter and fear. I must tell you frankly that Tom Gilman did not make it through the terrible fight. Our position being located in a copse, much firing during which I heard a cry, Tom is hit and fallen, our brave and noble friend laying upon his face upon the ground. I directed the boys that we would avenge even if it meant stepping through the very gates of hell. Such is the state of my mind that though I know we set off in that direction and with that intent, what happened next I cannot recall. Only that all is well, and I embrace my faithful pen to inform you I am at present safe and hope these lines find my dear little family enjoying the same great blessing. I arrived here at this place by distant journey and confined all the while. It was a terrible fight, as I believe I wrote you. Tom Gilman is dead, as I believe I wrote you. But he who preserves or destroys by his whim saw fit to preserve me to write these lines to you. To say that although confined, I count my blessings. I am weary to the point I can scarcely tell where I am or how I got here. I await the nurse. Trees hang down, breeze blows. I am somewhat blue and afraid. Oh, my dear, I have a foreboding, and I feel I must not linger in this place of great sadness. He who preserves and loves us scarcely present. And since we must endeavor always to walk beside him, I feel I must not linger, but am confined in mind and body, and unable, as if manacled, to leave at this time, dear wife. I must seek and seek. What is it that keeps me in this abysmal, sad place?
Captain William Prince.
A figure now burst up from the mounded earth like some wild creature sprung from a cage and began pacing about, anxiously gazing into the faces of Mr. Muller, Mrs. Sparks, and the others.
A soldier. In uniform.
Don't be afraid, someone drawled from the crowd. You was in that old place, and now you's in this new place here.
The soldier became translucent to the point of invisibility, as sometimes happens with us during intense cogitation, and, head first, re-entered the sick hole. Then of the instant was out again, look of bleak wonderment upon his face.
Dear wife of my heart, O Laura Bunny, inside my confinement is my trappings. I have just now looked, my cheek mole and hairline exact. It is uncomfortable to behold. With a sad look on the burned face, and the torso marred by a grave wound difficult to... I am here, am trapped here, and I see of this instant what I must do to get free. Which is tell the truth, and all shall be... Oh, I can't tell. Shall I tell? Shall I tell all? I feel I must, or stay forever in this drear and awful... Laura, send the little ones away and see that they cannot hear what comes next. I consorted with the smaller of the two, I did, in that rude hamlet. Consorted with the smaller of the two, and she asked after the locket you had given me, and asked, is she a good wife? Even as she, atop me, gave a little thrust of the hips and looked me in the eye as to disgrace your honor. But I assure you that, even as she thrust twice more, I still locked on mine. I did not give her that satisfaction. Did not sully your name or memory, although to serve truth and thereby escape this place, I feel I must freely confess that as she bent low to proffer her womanly charms, one of them and then the other to my mouth, asking, did my wife do this? Was my wife as wild? I made an expulsion of breath that we both understood to mean, no, my wife does not. My wife is not as free. And all the further time we consorted there in that dirty leaning shed, where her three babes did sleep on in their crude crib, and her two pale sisters and her mother did cackle from the yard. She kept the locket clenched in one hand, and when done, asked could she keep it? but my foul lust now wrung out of me, I answered sharply that she could not, and took me to the woods, where I wept, and there thought with true tenderness of you, and decided it was kinder to deceive. To deceive you.
He was pacing a wide, stumbling circle now, head and hands.
The moon was high, and I said to myself, sometimes a man must preserve the peace and spare the one he loves, which I have done, until now. I planned to tell you this not in a letter, but in person, when perhaps the warmth of the telling might soften the blow. But my situation appearing hopeless in the extreme, my homecoming now never to occur, I tell all to you, cry out to you in truest voice. I fucked the smaller of the two. I did it. In hopes that you, and he who hears and forgives all, will hear and forgive all, and allow me now to leave this wretched.
Then a blinding flash of light came from near the obelisk, and the familiar yet always bone-chilling fire sound associated with the matter-like blooming phenomenon.
And he was gone.
His shabby uniform pants raining down, and his shirt, and his boots, and his cheap iron wedding ring.
Some of the lesser members of the gathered crowd now began running amok, mocking at the soldier, inflicting various perverse and disrespectful postures upon his sick mound. Not out of meanness, for there is no meanness in them, but rather from excess of feeling. In this they can be like wild dogs let into a slaughterhouse, racing about upon the spilled blood, driven mad by the certainty that some sort of satisfaction must be near at hand.
My goodness, I thought, poor fellow. You did not give this place a proper chance, but fled it recklessly, leaving behind forever the beautiful things of this world. And for what? You do not know. A most unintelligent wager. Forgoing eternally, sir, such things as, for example, two fresh-shorn lambs bleat in a new-mown field. Four parallel blind-cast linear shadows creep across the sleeping tabby's midday flank. Down a bleached slate roof and into a patch of wilting heather bounce nine gust-loosened acorns. Up past the shaving fellow wafts the smell of a warming griddle, an early morning pot clangs and kitchen girl chatter. In a nearby harbor, a mansion-sized schooner tilts to port, sent so by a flag-rippling, chime-inciting breeze that causes, in the portside schoolyard, a chorus of childish squeals and the mad barking of what sounds like a dozen...
Friend, now is hardly the time.
Many apologies. But as I believe you must know, the thing is not entirely under my control.
The crowd, having suspended its perversities, stood gaping at Mr. Bevins, who had acquired in the telling such a bounty of extra eyes, ears, noses, hands, etc., that he now resembled some overstuffed fleshly bouquet. Bevins applied his usual remedy, closing the eyes and stopping as many of the noses and ears as he could with the various extra hands, dulling thereby all sensory intake, thus quieting the mind. And multiple sets of the eyes, ears, noses, and hands retracted or vanished. I could never tell which. The crowd returned to its abuse of the soldier's sick mound. Badger Muller pretending to piss upon it, Mrs. Sparks squatting over it, screwing her face into an ugly grimace. "Look here," she grunted, "I leave the coward a gift."
42.
And we proceeded on.
Walk skimming between, or over, when unavoidable, the former home places of so many fools no longer among us.
Goodson, Reynolds, Slocum, Mackey, Van Dyke, Pieser, Slider, Peck, Safko, Swift, Roseboom.
For example.
Simpkins, Warner, Persons, Lanier, Dunbar, Schumann, Hollingshead, Nelson, Black, Van Dusen.
These were, it must be conceded, in the majority, outnumbering our ilk by perhaps an order of magnitude.
Coppendale, Hagerdown, Messerschmitt, Brown.
Underscoring the exceptional qualities of those of us who soldiered on.
Coe, Mumford, Risley, Rowe, their places were so quiet, and from these, at dusk, as we whirled out of our respective home places, nothing whirled out whatsoever, and the contents of their
sick boxes
lay down there, inert, discarded, neglected.
Regrettable.
Like discarded horses waiting in vain for beloved riders to return.
Edgemont, Toady, Blazingame, Free.
Habernot, Bueller, Darby, Kerr.
These were a chirpy, tepid, desireless sort, generally, and had lingered, if at all, for only the briefest of moments. So completely satisfactory had they found their tenure in that previous place.
Smiling, grateful, gazing about themselves in wonder, favoring us with a last fond look as they
surrendered.
Succumbed.
Capitulated.
43.
We found the gentleman as had been described to us, near Bellingweather, husband-father shipwright.
Sitting cross-legged and defeated in a patch of tall grass.
As we approached, he lifted head from hands and heaved a great sigh. He might have been, in that moment, a sculpture on the theme of loss.
"Shall we?" Mr. Volman said. I hesitated. "The Reverend would not approve," I said. "The Reverend is not here," he said.
44.
In order to occupy the greatest percentage of the gentleman's volume, I lowered myself into his lap and sat cross-legged, just as he was sitting.
The two now comprised one sitting man, Mr. Volman's great girth somewhat overflowing the gentleman, his massive member existing wholly outside the gentleman, pointing up at the moon.
It was quite something. Quite something in there. "Bivens, come in," I called out. "This is not to be missed."
I went in, assuming the same cross-legged posture.
And the three of us were one.
So to speak.
45.
There was a touch of prairie about the fellow.
Yes.
Like stepping into a summer barn late at night.
Or a musty plains office where some bright candle still burns.
Vast. Wind-swept. New. Sad.
Spacious, curious, doom-minded, ambitious.
Back slightly out.
Right boot chafing.
The recent entry of the youthful Mr. Bevins now caused the gentleman a mild thought swerve, back to a scene from his own wild youth. A soft-spoken but retrograde, dirty cheeks, kind eyes, lass, leading him shyly down a muddy path, nettles accruing on her swaying green skirt, as, in his mind at the time, a touch of shame rose up, having to do with his sense that this girl was not really fair game, i.e. was more beast than lady, i.e. did not even know how to read.
Becoming aware of that which he was remembering, the man's face reddened, we could feel it reddening, at the thought that he was, in the midst of this tragic circumstance, remembering such a sordid incident.
And he hurriedly directed his, our, mind elsewhere, so as to leave this inappropriate thought behind.
46.
Tried to see his boy's face.
Couldn't.
Tried to hear the boy's laugh.
Couldn't.
Attempted to recall some particular incident involving the boy and hoped this might...
First time we fitted him for a suit. Thus thought the gentleman. This did the trick. First time we fitted him for a suit. He looked down at the trousers and then up at me, amazed, as if to say, "Father."